Hi everyone and welcome to the History of England. 147A, the pitfalls of being an Anglo-Saxon or medieval queen. Now I know what you're thinking. Here's David again, another week, another episode. But although this sounds like me, it is in fact really not. It is in fact Melisande of Outremer here, doing a guest episode for that idle layabout, David Crowther. From an early time, women who took upon the mantle of queenship were assigned a very limited role. That is, providing their king with an heir and spares, having a negligible political role and undertaking charitable works, preferably with a religious bent. This role would generally have accommodated contemporary opinions that a woman should be a dutiful wife and have no influence over the politics of the day. But even in assuming this passive role, some medieval queens have found that public and contemporary opinion could be very damaging indeed. Here we'll look briefly at the flip side of queenship and refer to some of England's Anglo-Saxon and medieval queens to illustrate our point. Typically, it was a young woman selected to be the consort of a king, a young woman whose youth would ensure a fruitful marriage, providing the heir and spares. However, there are many instances where the young woman was married off to a king considerably older in age, and what then? More often than not, there would be no child from the union. This was the fate of Edith Godwinson, who was married to Edward the Confessor, Adeliza of Louvain, second wife of Henry I, and Catherine Howard, married to Henry VIII. And should this older monarch depart the earth at any point during the marriage, then what of the succession? A break in the line, succession passing to another branch, or another monarch completely. Again, poor Edith Godwinson is our example. Alternatively, marriage to an older monarch could mean a previous marriage or marriages with other children, and thus rivals to any child born from this current union. Emma of Normandy, Judith of Flanders, Elfrith of Devon would have experienced this as all of them married men with children from prior unions, children who had just as good a claim on the succession as their own offspring. So what was a woman to do? Judith married her stepson to retain her throne after her first marriage, but like Edith and Adeliza, bore no child from either union. Elfrith has been accused of murdering her son's rival to ensure her own son's succession. And Emma of Normandy set about slandering her rival to gain credibility for her own child's claim. The fate of the childless queen was not one to be envied. Margaret of Anjou spent approximately 9 years of marriage to Henry VI before conceiving, only for the rumour mill to go into full swing and suggest that Henry was not the father after all. Edith Godwinson's fertility was heavily speculated about, with no child from her marriage to Edward. And the wives of Henry VIII famously had the most to lose in this quest for a legitimate son. Catherine of Aragon was unceremoniously cast aside, Anne Boleyn lost her head to the axeman, and poor Jane Seymour departed her mortal coil shortly after the birth of her son. It was through children, however, that a queen could often aspire to some influence. It was said that Osberga held some sway over her son Alfred the Great. Elfrith of Devon certainly had influence over her son, Ethelred II, and Eleanor of Aquitaine incited her own sons to rebel against their father, Henry II, on numerous, well-documented occasions. And where was this pool of eligible princesses? From the early medieval period, English kings often sought a spouse from foreign shores, rather than from local noble families. Rarely was a royal marriage a love match, the possible exception, so we're told, being Matilda of Flanders and William the Conqueror, and Eleanor of Aquitaine to Henry II, or in the beginning at least. The majority of marriages were for purely political reasons. Alliances to end wars, such as Catherine of Valois to Henry V, and Margaret of Anjou to Henry VI. Or alliances to strengthen already established political relations, such as Eldgith of Mercia to Harold II, and Berengaria of Castile to Richard I. Or, finally, to enlarge their own realms, such as Eleanor of Aquitaine's marriage to Henry II. Of course, the feelings of the young future queen were not considered when forming such political matches. Isabella of France unluckily married to Edward II, and quite possibly Margaret of Anjou, married to Henry VI with his many afflictions, are two of what we would consider the unluckier of English queens. Some women were married solely for their bloodline. Matilda of Scotland married to Henry I for her Anglo-Saxon bloodline, and thus the marriage uniting both Norman and Anglo-Saxon lines into one, strengthening Henry's claim in the process. The fact that many queens were foreign aroused antagonism within their new kingdom. French queens had the hardest time of it, especially in times of animosity between the country of their birth and the country of their marriage. Often these young princesses were considered ambassadors of their fathers, putting forward the interests of their family as opposed to that of their husbands, a fine balancing act for a woman whose offspring would inherit the lands of her consort. These same queens were often held to blame for the military failures of their husbands, so the nubile Isabella of Angoulême was rumoured to have kept her husband King John preoccupied in the marital bed, and was consequently blamed for the loss of English lands in Normandy. While Margaret of Anjou was blamed for the marriage treaty by which Anjou and Maine were returned by England to France at the beginning of the period known to us as the Wars of the Roses. In order to feel more at home in a strange land, many consorts brought with them an entourage of varying sizes to make them feel less ostracised and to maintain some sort of link to their home country. Unfortunately, the larger the entourage, the more mouths to feed, and positions within the court to find, often at the expense of nobles and other royal relations of the monarch. The 13-year-old Eleanor of Provence, wife to Henry III, brought with her to England an entourage reputedly numbering 170 people, including a number of uncles, three who would feature prominently at court, and one named as Archbishop. A further 70 or so were said to have remained in England, forming an influential political group at court. All these appointments, made to appease the Queen, came at the expense of those nobles loyal to Henry, and were a contributing factor in the brewing baronial discontent. Elizabeth Woodville, on her marriage to Edward IV, brought with her a small army of relatives, whom Edward favoured above his loyal nobles, with court positions, marriages, and patronage scattered like seeds in a field. Later monarchs would learn from this, with Henry VII severely limiting the number of persons remaining in England from the entourage of Catherine of Aragon. Of course, Henry was truly penny-pinching. Fewer mouths to feed equaled less money from his treasury. Language itself may also have been another hurdle for the young queen to overcome. Not all consorts were fluent in the language of their spouse. This in itself creates a feeling of isolation. Some women sought to learn the language of their new realm, or find some amicable middle road. For others, the road to integration was long and arduous, such as that of Catherine of Braganza, wife to Charles II. And what of those women for whom fate was not so kind, married to a future king, but never herself attaining the crown? Two women stand out here, Isabella of Gloucester, who was married to John prior to his accession, and Mary de Bohun, married to Henry IV, again prior to his accession. To this we might controversially add Eleanor Butler, reputed wife of Edward IV. And fate again would be unkind to many queens whose husband's roving eye fell upon some pretty young thing at court. Many a queen turned a blind eye, passing these off as a flight of fancy that would fade with time. But this wasn't always the case. Eleanor of Aquitaine endured two women who were not a passing fancy of Henry, the fair Rosamond and Alace of France. Eleanor was, during her imprisonment, constantly badgered to submit to a divorce, and similarly accused of murdering one of her rivals while still incarcerated. Catherine of Aragon had the ignominy of being brought before an ecclesiastical court to swear there was no union with her first husband, of being imprisoned and separated from her daughter, of Henry's break with the Church of Rome thus nullifying her own marriage and coronation, and of having another anointed in her place during her lifetime. Even Anne Boleyn didn't learn from her own actions, with her own lady-in-waiting succeeding her as mistress and then queen of Henry VIII. And what of the fate of the queen upon the death of her spouse? The cloister was one route, and some did avail themselves. Ethelfleda of Wiltshire, wife to Edmund I, Ethelfleda the Fair, wife to King Edgar, Berengaria of Navarre, Eleanor of Aquitaine. Some were sent into forcible retirement, such as Elizabeth Woodville and Isabella of France. and a few went on to marry again, and of those, two made very controversial unions. Catherine of Valois, first wife of Henry V to Owen Tudor, and Isabella of Angoulême, first wife of John I to Hugh de Lusignan. And both did so without the permission of their king, their sons, and the offspring of these marriages would return to stir up trouble in the kingdom in years to come. And of those queens who died before their spouse, some have faded from the pages of history, some have remained to us to this day, and for the unlucky few, better they did not leave to see the turmoil brought about by their offspring. This is only a fleeting glimpse into the other side of medieval queenship, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you, Melisande, and by the way, if you'd like to find out more, then hie thee to the interweb and womenofhistory.blogspot.com. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week.